Hey, this is Meredith. We're taking this week off so we can put some extra time into a very special episode of The Unfolding to mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11. The stories we're sharing will give you a glimpse into what some people experienced that day, including how one man witnessed the hand of God inside the World Trade Center. We really want you to hear these stories, so we're going to release this episode early. Look for our special 9/11 edition of The Unfolding this Wednesday, September 8th. But we know you love to hear great stories every Friday, so today we've pulled one from our archives. It's the story of Sarah DeRosha and how her training as a trauma nurse was the key to surviving a terrible accident on a mission trip to Bolivia. Page 40 of The Unfolding is the story of Sarah DeRosha.
Having worked on level one trauma victims, I knew that my chances of survival were bleak to none. I said, Lord, I'm ready. Like, if this is it for me, then call me home to Jesus.
God's story has been unfolding.
Since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in The Unfolding.
Hi, this is Meredith Foster. Sometimes when we follow God's lead, we end up in a place that we never expected. Sarah DeRosha felt called to take care of people. She used her training as a level one trauma nurse to help others, both at her work and on medical missions trips. While on a journey to the most remote area of Bolivia, Sarah was involved in a terrible accident. Suddenly, her trauma training was the key to her own survival.
I'm a nurse. At the time, I had just accepted my dream job in Nashville, Tennessee as a level one trauma nurse. And I had moved down there to be near a guy that I had been engaged to. Our relationship was kind of on the rocks. At the time, I was 25. I really accepted this job. I was leaving home and my family, and you know, I was excited because I had planned a mission trip to go to Bolivia, and I was just really trusting the Lord because I had a feeling that I was not supposed to marry the guy that I was marrying. I just had a lot of turmoil inside myself regarding this relationship. So I had gone before to Bolivia the year prior in 2013 to do a medical missions trip with a couple Cold Water Ministries, and fell in love with the people, fell in love with that mission organization, and just, I loved it. And I just couldn't wait to go back. And an opportunity came in 2014 to return, but for an extended period of time this time.
So how long were you going to be there?
Initially, I think the trip was originally like 9 or 10 days. The Lord had told me, I want you to go longer. So at that point, it was like 2.5 weeks. And I knew what I'd be doing the first 9 to 10 days. We knew we had clinics set up very similar to the year prior, but the second half of the trip, God never gave me clarity. He was just like, I just want you to go. And so I just said, okay, Lord, I'm going to go. And there was nobody else staying longer with me except for the director of our mission, his wife, and myself. So it was just the three of us. The rest of the mission team came home. And the first leg of the trip was awesome. We did multiple medical clinics, serviced almost 1,000 people. We did a bunch of free surgeries too. And
tell me about the population in Bolivia. What is it like there?
Oh, it's super poor. It's one of the poorest countries in South America. One child out of 16 die before the age of 5. 73% of people don't have access to basic sanitation.
Wow.
60% of the Bolivians live below the national poverty line.
So the first 9 days, you're providing medical care. And then what happened?
After that, we said goodbye to our team, me and the director of our mission organization, Dan Hennepin, and his wife, Marcy. And we dropped him off at the airport, and the three of us headed to a different area of Bolivia. We had been serving in the lowlands, and then we were flying up to the capital, La Paz, and we were going to travel to an area called Caranavi and minister with some of our missionaries under our Cup of Cold Water Ministries mission organization. And we had did that, and then I said goodbye to the director of the mission and our missionaries there, and I traveled by taxi to meet one of our other missionaries and a dear friend of mine, Phil Kettleson, who's been a longtime missionary in Bolivia. He had served with us the week before. Him and I were going to travel. He was in his early 60s, and he was going to take me to very remote areas of Bolivia, more than where we had been prior the week before, and we were going to go together, and he was going to preach at a church, and I'd set up clinics for some schools, and that's when the real story begins. After my journey in La Paz, we carried on to, you know, different locations in Bolivia, more mountainous terrain. And eventually we made it by bus to a place called Salar de Uyuni, or Uyuni, which is really known for its vast, famous salt flat. And it's about 4,086 square miles, and it contains 70% of the world's lithium reserve. It's just this flat, vacant, arid land. High altitude, extreme elements, beautiful, absolutely breathtaking. It's the largest salt flat in the world. There's no roads, no speed limits, but we were traveling from one town that was on one side of it. You can't inhabit the salt flat. You can't live on it. And we were going to go across the salt flat to another town and set up a medical clinic at
a school.
And
there's no road?
There's no road. You just drive on the salt flat. Yeah.
Okay.
People travel back and forth. There are a lot of indigenous people that live up in this area. It's desolate. I remember leaving Uyuni, which was the town we had just been at. Phil had just preached at the church that morning. I remember being like, it's just this heavy darkness there. It's very arid and they need Jesus, you know, and you could just feel this heaviness there. And I remember loading the bus that morning. I had called my mom that morning. I found a place with Wi-Fi, which was miraculous. And I remember leaving on the bus thinking, God, I don't ever want to come back to this town. It was just so heavy. And we get on the bus and we load up with 44 people total and a lot of indigenous Aymara people and Bolivians. And we start our journey across the salt flat to the other side where we would be at a school and I'd set up clinics and minister care to children and Phil would share the gospel.
And how long would that trip be to go across?
I think it was about 2 hours. We had really good driving conditions that day. Based on the weather, you can't even travel across. But it was super sunny. The skies were blue. It was cool. But yeah, so we left. Traveling on the bus, Phil, the missionary, was with us, and I started to smell gasoline. And I go, Phil, you smell that? He goes, yeah, I smell that. And he talks to the man in front of him who's Bolivian. They're speaking Spanish. And so the man in front of us goes up to the driver and says, hey, we smell gasoline. And so the driver stops the bus. He gets out of the bus and he checks the luggage compartments underneath the bus. And the indigenous people will travel with containers of gasoline that aren't capped.
Oh my.
And they load them onto the bus because they're trying to get to the other side to bring gasoline to family friends whose cars have broken down or what have you.
Oh, wow.
So gas was just spilling all within the luggage compartment of the bus. So after he stops, I said, oh, Phil, can we get off and get a picture? So Phil and I run down and he gets a picture of me because this is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. And we get back on the bus real quick. And as soon as I got on the bus, I just became super tired. I can't explain it. We had been traveling a lot and could have been the elements somewhat, but I believe it was also the Lord. I just leaned my head against the window of the bus and I think I had fallen asleep for just a few minutes before I woke up because our bus had been hit by an SUV. Randomly.
Out in the middle of the salt flat?
In the middle of nowhere, yeah. Yeah, we were hit with an SUV. In the SUV, there were four men. So I hit my head on the window on impact, and the bus rocked back and forth. Significantly, the bus lost control, and eventually it flipped to the side.
About how fast were you going?
I mean, we were just traveling probably a little less than highway speed, I'd imagine, but I was sleeping, so I don't remember. But
okay.
Enough to cause the bus to lose control, and it fell on its left side. I was sitting on the left side by the window. I hit my head on the window on impact, and then, you know, we skidded. It was reported I had been knocked out. And I remember vaguely in and out of memory, just skidding. I was told it was between 50 and 80 feet because some of the missionaries had returned back to the accident site and had measured it. I lost consciousness on impact. And when I woke up very briefly, I just hear screaming, people like, oh God, help us. Some in English, some in Spanish, mostly Spanish. And I can hear Phil distinctly in Spanish, Jesus be with us, Jesus be with us. People are screaming, they're crying, they're panicking. I didn't realize at the time, but I can hear Phil saying, Sarah, you know, are you okay? And I had been covered in luggage from the luggage racks. Seats had been disconnected. It was a very violent impact. And I woke up and I touched my face with my right hand. It was blood. I was wet with blood, just soaked. And
did you have a sense that it was yours or someone? Did you have any idea?
I had no idea whose it was. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like trying to move, realizing I can't move. And I look down. This is all happening very quickly. I realize that my arm is actually pinned out of the window under the bus. And the blood is coming from my head because my arm is also covered in blood. And by the time I realize this, I can hear Phil saying, Sarah, your hand is stuck, you're pinned, you know, over and over again. And I'm like, oh, I'm pinned, you know, it's like, oh, okay. I come to very quickly and I feel my head and everybody's crawling, they're crawling over us. We're more towards the back. So not many people had crawled over us, but people were exiting the bus, trying to help people out, screaming, crying still. And Phil's like, you're stuck. He's like, I will be right back. And Phil leaves. And before I know it, I'm totally in the bus alone. Everybody is out of the bus. I can't get out. I look down, my radial artery has been severed. And then, you know, you can bleed out from an artery, you know, in 2 minutes or less. And so I immediately apply pressure with my right arm and I just did what any trauma nurse would do. Where are you at? What's the date today? Who's the president of the United States? And I just start going through these thoughts with me. Okay, do I have an acute brain injury? You know, is my brain okay? Is my chest okay? Am I breathing okay? And all those things, I just checked the box. You know, I have the bleeding under my wrist under control for this moment. And then I was pinned in a way that my legs were underneath me. So I'm like, okay, are my legs broken? Well, I don't know, but I'm going to try to get up on them. So I tried to get my legs up underneath me.
Oh my gosh. All while applying pressure to your, okay. Wow.
Yeah. And still bleeding from my head. And so I get my legs underneath me and I'm like, I got to stop the bleeding from my arm. At the time all this is happening, Phil crawls in through the glass, crawls in through the debris and says, Sarah, the jack is rusted to the bus. We can't get the jack off the bus. And so they were trying to get the jack off to let me out. I couldn't do it. But he came in with a pipe. He tried to kind of lever up from where I was at and it just wasn't working. The pain is starting to set in. I said, Phil, I need your belt. Like he had a belt on and he...
Thank God.
Yeah, thank God. So he just takes his belt off and he hands it to me. I'm like, I need it as a tourniquet. So he kind of helped it get under my arm. So we get the belt under my arm and I'm holding it. Phil leaves again to find the pipe didn't work. He leaves again. He's making phone calls all over the country, United States, trying to get us help because we're 2 hours away from any civilization, very remote. He contacts the missionaries we were headed to. He called the university center I'd been working for in Nashville. He's just making desperate calls. The
embassy, anywhere, anybody. Somebody. Yeah.
His family, you know. Phil gets on the phone. He calls my mom and dad in the States. My mom picks up the phone. Phil says, we've been in a terrible accident. Sarah's trapped under the bus and his phone loses minutes and cuts out. So, I mean, my parents are paralyzed. They thought I had died. At our home church, our missions team was meeting because they were getting ready to send a team. So they had been getting ready and she called our senior pastor's wife and they came over to my mom's right away. And before you know it, I'm still trapped in the bus, but there are people all over Bolivia praying for me. I had me and Phil covered in prayer from, you know, California all the way to Maine, you know, just because of family and friends and the community of Christians. And but then...
So meanwhile, on the bus, you've got the belt on your arm.
Yes.
But you're still bleeding from the head. Did you have head injury as well?
Yeah, I was still bleeding from the head and my arm, because the belt, I didn't have the strength to keep it tight. Mm-hmm. I'm using my teeth to hold it, I'm balancing with my right arm, and it's still bleeding. So... Phil at the time was working very hard to free me and get connections to get us rescued. And he had sent healthy individuals that had been okay, younger. One, I think, was a med student. He had found out it was Bolivian, and another young girl was a Bolivian. And they'd come in. The young gentleman came in beside me and he crawls in through my blood, through the glass to sit with me for a little bit of time. And I could see my travel pack and I knew I had supplies on me. And so I couldn't reach it. I asked him, hey, can you hand me that? He goes, yeah. And then all of a sudden I see Phil's hat, also in the rubble, had this gold rope. It was kind of like a cowboy hat. I thought, even before we left, I was like, why is he bringing a cowboy hat? That is the strangest. I have a snow cap. You know, it's cold. We're in the mountains. And he had said that he had packed the wrong hat, you know, because he had had that the week before in the warmer lowlands. And I said, hey, I asked this guy, can you give me the hat? I need this rope. And so he hands me the hat. I get the rope off. In the meantime, he's getting me out Tylenol. I'm chewing Tylenol. It's all I had.
And what was your pain like at that point?
I was starting to set in. It was hurting. You know, the nurse's pain scale, 0 to 10. Give me the most, it's like not even on the scale.
Off the charts.
Off the charts. And so then he gives me this rope. I can't tie it tight enough. I'm not strong enough with one arm and trying to control bleeding. So I look at him, and my broken Spanish, you know, he didn't speak English. I just, with eyes filled with like pleading, can you please tie this, you know? And he understood what I meant. And he just looked at me like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah. And so he tied the rope really tight. And that's when the pain was off the charts. You know, I just looked away and bit down, and she tied it. The bleeding stopped. At a certain point, initially when I was just alone, I just remember being like, having worked on level one trauma victims, I knew that my chances of survival were bleak to none.
Sarah's experience as a trauma nurse told her her situation was dire. There was no one near to rescue her. The only way she would survive would be if God intervened. The rest of Sarah's story is coming up. But first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute.
I've often heard you talk about adversity, especially in your career, as it can actually be helpful to you in the long run.
It's hard while you're going through it. Absolutely hard. But you look back at it and you say, thank God it happened to me. It stretched me. It made me different, made me better. God doesn't say that the path is going to be easy. The disciples in the first century were killed. If they were killed, I can handle some adversity at work. But sometimes there's abuse and really tough times. My heart goes out for the people who are having a hard time. But I think knowing your value and your purpose allows you to be able to go through these, even though your boss may not be a Christian, even though your boss may be cruel, because many people of faith worked, like Joseph worked for Potiphar, who was enriched because of that. Pharaoh was enriched because of Joseph. And Joseph said, my purpose was to save the nation of Israel by bringing them down into the land of Goshen during the famine. So his purpose trumped the fact that he was working in a difficult environment. That's my encouragement to people who are having difficulty.
And if you need a little encouragement to help you get through the adversity, your website is full of motivational minutes, videos. Where could they find out more?
HabibHabib.com, H-A-B-E-E-B, HabibHabib.com.
And now, back to Sarah's story.
Having worked on level one trauma victims, I knew that my chances of survival were bleak to none. 2 hours away from any civilization, not in America, my radial artery is severed, I'm bleeding from my head. And at that point, I prayed. I said, Lord, I'm ready. Like if this is it for me, then call me home to Jesus, because it's by your grace and your mercy that you have already rescued me. But if you have something more for me this side of heaven, you gotta make it happen, because I need your strength to get me out of here. I can't do it. And then that was the most peace I've ever experienced from the point of salvation until this very day. And if I could ever have that peace again, I want it back. That was supernatural. I can't explain it, but it was a gift from God, the side of heaven, and I may never experience that. And a lot of people walk through life not having those experiences or that feeling from the Holy Spirit or assurance that Christ is with us in our brokenness and desperation. But he is, and he gifted me that. And he was very present with me. From that moment on, he just equipped me with whatever it was to continue on, to wake up each morning. Phil came back in, checked on me a couple times, and then a young girl came in, probably around the same age as me. I was 26. She came in at this point. We're getting towards about the hour mark.
Everybody else got off. Were other people injured?
So there were 44 people on the bus. 16 were injured. I was obviously the worst. The 4 men that were in the SUV, 3 of them were killed.
Oh, devastating.
And this young girl came in. She holds my hand, and I asked her if she believed in God. She said she did. I called her my sister in Spanish, and then she lets go of my hand. I can hear rustling through the rubble, and I look, and she finds the spoon, and she's just carving in between the broken windows into the ground just for, like, dear life.
With a spoon?
A spoon. She was like, I'm going to get this girl out. I don't care what it takes. I don't even care if I'm not anywhere near her body. I'm going to dig until something happens. And I just asked her for it, and she looked at me, and she, like, gives it to me, and I just started to dig my hand out with a spoon. It was like a soup spoon, something you just find, like, a big tablespoon. Before you know it, I'm out, and I'm like, oh, my arm. So I had gloves on, and I could tell that it was shattered, just totally shredded. I didn't know at the time that Phil had already picked up my fingers from the accident, you know, along the pathway, or somebody had picked him up.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't know that for the longest time. Phil didn't tell me that right away, which is probably good. You know, when you're a trauma victim, you don't want to hear that. But he had thought maybe if I did get rescued, they might be able to reattach him. So he had those on him, and I didn't know. In the accident, I ended up losing a majority of my hand. I have most of my wrist. I lost 4 fingers in the accident. The 5th one they had to amputate because it was unsalvageable. So then I got out, and I took off the scarf I had on, wrapped my arm in it, and I just started yelling, "Phil, Phil, I'm out, I'm free." And I could see the roof of the bus was behind me, and I turned to my left side, and I could see that, you know, the exit was there, and I get over to that area, and I didn't have the strength to actually climb out of the bus. And it was just like all these arms just reached in, and they just carried me out. Phil was one of them, and they just laid me into the shade of the bus. And I remember laying down, looking up. I could see the wheel of the bus just slowly turning. And Phil goes, "Sarah, hang on. Help is on the way. Help is coming." And I'm like, "Phil, this is it. Like, it's okay. I'm not going to make it. Like, just leave me here to die. It's all right." And he's like, "No, you have to stay with me. Help is coming. Help is on the way." And then I just started to yell out, you know, "Thanks for everyone for helping me." And I started to tell him about Jesus. Jesus is love. Like, it's okay that I die because, you know, Christ is with me. And then Phil just stopped talking to me, and he just started translating it to Spanish. So he just started sharing. And then two transport vehicles arrived. They weren't like an American ambulance, let me tell you. It was basically like a conversion van with a gurney. They start to pick me up to put me in a gurney. I said, "Phil, if there's no oxygen, I will not make the hour and a half or 2 hour drive back to the town we had just left from."
You're still a trauma nurse.
Yeah, I'm like, "I'm not going to make it. Like, just leave me here. It's a beautiful place to die. I'm going to see Jesus. It's okay." I'm like, "I have to have oxygen. But if somebody else needs it, give it to them. Like, you know." And he's like, no, "I'll get you oxygen." And so they put me in the transport. When we got into the van, I said, "Phil, we got to call my family." At this point, Phil had minutes added to his phone from, you know, friends and family. And I just knew I had to call him. It was like eating at me. Like, I had to talk to them. My dad picks up the phone and I'm like, "Hey, Dad." He's like, "Oh my gosh, it's so good to hear your voice." I'm like, "I'm okay. I'm hurt. I'm hurt bad, but I'm all right." And he's just like, "Just hang in there. We're praying for you. We love you. The Lord is with you." And then we went back to the town I said I never wanted to go back to. God's got a funny sense of humor. So we went back to Uyuni, the town we had just came from, and there was a little hospital there. They didn't know, you know, where hospital to send me to afterwards, because they knew that I had a head injury. They didn't know the extent, and they knew that my arm was badly injured, and they're different specialties. And they're in different, the specialists are in different parts of the country, and nothing's easily traveled by vehicle. And so they decided, okay, we're going to send her to the capital, and we're going to try to get her orthopedic. The problem was, though, there was no transport plane. So it'd take hours, 10, 15 hours to get there by transport vehicle. And the other thing to top it off was there was a hail and lightning storm coming through the mountains. We had a few options for planes. One was a missionary pilot that was way off some other part of the country, couldn't get back soon enough. But then Phil's son was living in the capital, and he went to a neighbor's house who was a high-ranking Bolivian Air Force pilot. And he said, "I need you to go rescue this girl and my dad, like, now." And he was like, "Oh, well, for $2,000 American cash, yeah, I can round up a plane and we'll go get him." So Joey got together a bunch of money with the help of our friends and missionary and Dan, and it's like, "Here's $2,000 American cash. Okay. They got on a plane. They came out to us. Still no pain medication. Yeah, still conscious. And I get back in a transport vehicle, and I didn't know that there was an impending storm coming. The plane is like still running. They get me out of this vehicle and they pull the gurney down. They're like, "Okay, stand up and walk into the plane." And I'm like, "I got to stand up. Like, I can barely see straight." And so I got off the gurney. Phil helped me, and they took the oxygen tank away. And I'm like, "Phil, I need that. Like, I know I need that." And they didn't want to give us the oxygen tank because resources are so limited. They were so like, "We need this for somebody else." And Phil's like, "I promise I'll send it full with payment back to you guys." And they were like, "Well, okay." So Phil gets me in. Pilot shuts the door. He goes up to the cockpit. We're not even strapped in, and the plane is like taking off. And I'm just like in this flight, and Phil is sitting on the aisle next to me, like with me every step of the way, talking to me every step of the way.
So how long since the time of the accident? Now, how many hours into it are we?
Might have been 4 or 5 hours at this point. Still no narcotic pain medicine and no blood, just some fluid. And they strap me in. We take off into the worst possible hail and lightning storm in the Andes Mountains you could ever think of. It is a miracle the plane did not crash. I remember just feeling like the plane would just literally drop from the sky, and to be caught back by a gust of wind and just navigating. It's dark. I've never been in war, but I imagine that the fierceness of the hail that is just pelting this metal plane is like bullets. I just remember being like, "God, please let me pass out. You're not going to let me die in a bus. I might die in a plane crash, But if not, like, just please let me pass out so I don't even remember this. I was awake the whole time. He did not let me lose consciousness. But when we landed, it was like the Lord just took that plane himself and just landed it with such grace. And then there for me, waiting for me, was a decent ambulance with a doctor, a Bolivian doctor who had done a little bit of training in the States, who Phil knew. Phil knows everybody in Bolivia. And I was just looked at him and I'm like, morphine, por favor, like, please, I need morphine. I need something because the pain is like my endorphins are gone at this point. I'm feeling everything from the impact of my head. I had the worst concussion. I had blurred vision and poor memory for like 8 months after. So all this is going on and he goes and he goes, I'm going to give you 1 milligram of morphine. We don't even use morphine in trauma. It is like, it's just nothing.
Like spitting in the ocean?
It's like spitting in the ocean. Yeah. And he's going to give me 1 milligram. And I was like, thank you, you know. And granted, I understand because he was concerned about my breathing. And I told him, I looked at him, if I haven't died yet, I'm not going to die. So give me more morphine. And he gave me some more. And we had about another maybe 45 minutes, hour ride down the mountains from El Alto, the airport, to this hospital, one of the better hospitals in Bolivia. And they had an orthopedic specialist. And there waiting for me when they pulled me off the ambulance were Dan and Marcy, the director of CUP, who had driven in from the jungle, multiple individuals who I had met and served with the week before, who were translators, Bolivians, who had all heard and been prayed. And they were there to welcome me. Like, Sarah, the Lord is here. The Lord is with you. We are with you. We know your family's not here, but we are your family. A United States doctor looked at me. He's a primary doctor. And he said, you know, you need surgery really bad. He said, well, can I have it back in the States? He goes, no, you need it now. I said, if this was your daughter, would you put her through this? And he goes, if it was the only option, yeah. The surgeon who worked on me did the best job he could. And I stayed 5 nights and 4 days at the Bolivia hospital, very limited pain medication. I was in excruciating pain. I remember just the, you know, friends would just be like, you just have to tell them you're in pain. Like, you have to scream it. Otherwise, they're just not going to take you seriously. I remember giving all the money that I had to my missionary friend. I said, go to the street and buy me whatever drugs you can. I made him a list.
Wow.
And he did. He left. I made him a list. I said, whatever you can find, give this, you know. And he went and came back with the same stuff they were giving me. Every night I wasn't alone, whether it was a missionary in the area staying with me or a friend or a local Christian. Like, they were coming in. They were praying over me. The very first night, one of the young girls I had served with, who was a translator for me the week before, her mom is a Christian, she came into the room. She sent everybody out of the room and she prayed over every window, every door frame. She covered me from toes to head and just bathed me in prayer. And I had never had a nightmare since. I have had peaceful sleep since the accident. God protected me, you know, he in all the details, in every single detail. And Dan, our administrator, was working so hard to get me a flight home. My parents didn't have passports, so they couldn't get out. I remember talking to the guy I was engaged with and seriously dating at the time, just saying, like, I'd already wanted to call it quits. He was not a good person, not a good guy. I remember just being like, you know what? Like, it's going to be a rough road. Like, it's okay. Move on. You know, just Lord's got me. Just move on with life. This isn't good. We're toxic. And you'd be like, no, like, I will be your other hand. I'm going to stand with you through all of this. And I'm going to love you in it. And I can't wait to see you. And he, you know, he was right there with me. And I believed it, you know, like, you're desperate, you know, you're hurting, you're in pain. And you're like, yes, like, okay, he's in this with me. I'm not alone. Like, and then a flight was provided and Dan and his wife, Marcy, escorted me. I had to get special permission from the orthopedic surgeon to be able to travel from Bolivia back to the States. Like, I was healthy enough to do it. I was not healthy enough to do it, but I begged him. He came in there and I was like, please. And I remember, like, Latin culture is very family oriented. And I would just look at him and I was like, I got to see my mom again. I got to see my family. Will you please just let me go see my family? If I don't make it, I don't make it, but I got to figure it out. And he eventually signed the waiver. But eventually we got the flights and I took 3 commercial flights in coach.
When you needed to be in ICU, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I had blood like caked in my hair. I was about as white as a piece of copy paper. And we made it to Miami. The emergency plan was to just have a bed for me at University of Miami for direct admission. And so if I was too sick or I just waved the flag, they would take me from the Miami airport to the University of Miami Medical Center. And we landed in Miami and I'm like, I'm just about home. Should I have been admitted in Miami? Yes, I shouldn't have gotten on that plane and kept going, but I wanted to see my family. So then we made the the flight from Miami to O'Hare, I always think, what did these people think when they saw me in this like alpaca poncho with massive blood clots in my hair, like puffy, faces bruised, you know? I'm like, so we made it to O'Hare International Airport. I was pumped. I was being wheeled out with Dan and Marcy by my side, and there waiting for me at the airport was my mom and dad, the guy I was engaged to, my brother, my sister, two really, really dear physician friends of mine, one I now work for. And so they were ready. They had a room ready. And my dad or someone was like, you need to call an ambulance. They could just tell. I was like gray. And I'm like, no, just throw me in the back of the car and get me there. Like, just, I don't want any time wasted. I need to get to the hospital now. My dad looked at me and he did exactly what I wanted. He threw me in the front of the car, and like, we just drove. They got me there and they admitted me. I stayed at the University of Chicago for 9 days. I had two surgeries in Bolivia. I underwent two more surgeries in the University of Chicago. A lot of healing. And then on discharge, I had a long road of home health. And 6 months after the last surgery, I had to go back in for a fifth surgery because I had glass that had healed within the wounds. And I developed three neuromas, which are like nerve tumors. They're like angry, raging nerve tumors. And I had horrible, severe phantom limb pain. So after having that fifth surgery and where they had to go in and remove the glass, it set me back 6 months in physical therapy. So I had more physical therapy after that. A few months after that, I had excruciating pain. I had been on and off narcotic pain medication, cold turkeying, I think 4 or 5 times, withdraw from hard, hard medications. And I had been clean off most meds, any narcotics, and the pain was excruciating. I couldn't live with it. I was just desperate. So I go back to one of my doctors, and he goes, hey, I have this buddy at Northwestern. We started a study. We think this might help with your phantom limb pain. And I had this new surgery, also set me back in physical therapy, had to go back on narcotics again. But it resolved the phantom limb pain after multiple months.
Wow.
And now it's the new way to actually surgically treat phantom limb pain for neuromas. So I underwent the sixth surgery about a year after. It was about a month from the year anniversary of the accident that I had that surgery. And within 6 months, I was back working part-time in an intensive care unit as a nurse.
Wow.
I remember going to my manager, who I'd worked with before I moved to Tennessee, and was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, this is all I know. Critical care is all I've ever done, and I don't know how I'm going to do it with one hand. And she goes, when you're ready for her job, you're not going anywhere else. You come back here. We're going to make it work. And I, you know, with their help and patience and kindness to me, we were able to get me back at the bedside. I was independent. By the time I left that job, I was training new nurses. Like, you know, so very fortunate. And I know I had mentioned I'd been engaged before too. And when I had came back from the airport initially after the accident, he had been there to receive me also with my family, and then stayed a couple days at the hospital, never stayed overnight with me. And then he didn't come back for a month later. And when he had come back, I had found out he had been unfaithful. And then at that point, I was like, I'm done. Like, you're free to go live your life, and I got to do my thing. And, you know, for a long time, like, you know, I talk about the story as if it's like easy and all these things happened. But like the pain, the physical pain is one thing. The emotional grieving of losing not just your physical hand, but like your dream job. You know, I couldn't do level one trauma anymore. That career path that I was headed down was gone. It was gone. And, you know, there's other things to grieve besides the physical loss of your hand. I had to grieve a relationship. I had to grieve the loss of a dream job. I had to grieve many things. And then the emotional and psychological trauma that come in too with the memories. And PTSD is a real thing, where any time you just hear the smallest sound, like somebody just gently shutting a door, would be enough to have me jump out of my skin. And emotionally, like, I was stable. I was working. I was progressing in life, but like psychologically, something else was going on much deeper. And clinically, I knew what it was because of what I do for a living. Until I was in biblical counseling, she was just like, you need some more help than what I can offer you. And I knew it. And I was like, at this point in my life, is this where I'm going to surrender to it? She goes, I want you to go see this trauma specialist. And I went, and I had been faithfully going to her. She just walked with me through the muck of the memory and the muck of the healing. And it would have been a lot easier, I think, to live on the narcotics to numb all aspects of the pain than it would be to get off of them, to recognize oh my goodness, I need help. My physical being, yes, the Lord is with me. Yes, I'm still serving him and walking in light of trauma, but I am still a human. I still have my human nature. I still have my brokenness and the pain that and all that it encompasses. But like, he will walk with us through it. We just have to be willing. I mean, thankfully, I walked with the Lord before. And during the incident, we had our conversations, God and I. You know, there are times I'd scream, I'd cry, but I never question God's purpose in it. It's always for his glory. I might not know what he's doing with it, but he always fulfills his purpose in a beautiful way, whatever that way is. We just got to be willing. We have to be submissive. And we have to understand that he loves us regardless of anything. It was always like, what are you doing with this? Like, what? And the other times I felt like, well, why me? Like, why did you give me this experience versus somebody else? I don't feel like I'm the one that can carry this story. It's almost like a gift, and I don't feel responsible enough to have this gift. But I think when God brings us through certain circumstances and allows us to experience him in a different way, he equips us for it. Really, we're unequipped. We're not the right person. And if you remember any of the giants of the Bible, neither were they. Like they're just normal people. And we just have to have the heart that loves the Lord and loves people. And he's going to do whatever with it.
I would be natural or maybe normal to say, after having that kind of experience, that you would say, I'm not going on another missions trip and I'm going to live life a little more. So tell me what your life has been like now that you've been through recovery.
So since Bolivia, during the recovery process, the first few years, I had actually gone back to graduate school. And because I didn't believe that I could go back to the nursing bedside, had a really great group of people who invested in me and were like, you're going to do great things. And if it means you need more education, we're going to put together a fund so you can get that education. And wow. I did. And I went to university and got my nurse practitioner degree. I'm currently using that right now, which is really awesome. And I wanted to go back on more missions trips. And since then, I was able to, you know, I was youth leader for a little bit with my church and went to Thailand to serve with missionaries out there. And I also went to Montana as a trip nurse for youth that did missions. And one day I'd like to go back to Bolivia. I really would love to. And the opportunity hasn't come yet to where I was at the time physically healthy or emotionally healthy, but I believe that I'm at the point now where that opportunity is more able to be captured. And I got married last year to a really awesome, godly man who loves the Lord, who loves me, who treasures me, everything that I come with. And, you know, life is hard, things are hard, and just trust Jesus through them. That's all I can say.
Because of her training in trauma, Sarah knows there is no way she should have survived. It's only by God's grace. Having a near-death experience has given her clarity about life and even more compassion for her patients and what they're going through. And the peace she experienced after her accident, it's given her a confidence that God's going to be with her no matter what she faces in the future. Sarah now serves on the board of the ministry that she was traveling with in Bolivia. If you would like to know more about Cup of Cold Water Ministry, you can go to ccwm.org. Thank you, Sarah, for sharing your story. And thank you for listening today. If you enjoy The Unfolding, would you leave a kind review and rating on Apple Podcasts? That helps others discover The Unfolding. Big thanks to Jason Rakow, our amazing producer, and to our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H-Squared Leadership Institute. Find out how he can help you unlock the full power of your leadership potential at HabibHabib.com. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll be back this Wednesday, September 8th, with a special edition of The Unfolding to mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11. This is an episode we've been working on for 6 months. The stories are incredible. You won't want to miss it.